As competitive athletes, we live to train for our sport. But serious training can also lead to serious health imbalances. It doesn't have to be this way. My name is Christopher Kelly. As co-founder of Nourish Balance Thrive, I help athletes achieve sustained, optimal performance and health. Now, the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast is bringing this mission to the world, sharing science-based information on the personalized lifestyle changes and interventions that help athletes go faster, feel better, and become truly elite competitors. Your journey to greatness starts now. Before we get into this week's podcast, after we finished recording, Megan and I realized there was a small error that Megan would like to correct now. Megan, could you go ahead and do that for us?
Sure. So when I was talking about acetylation in the context of HDAC inhibition, I said the wrong thing as far as what an acetyl group is. And so I just wanted to correct that for all the biochemists out there who might pick up on it. So an acetyl group is a CH3 C double bond O group.
And that mistake will be corrected in the transcript. So if you come to my website, nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast, drill down to an individual podcast, then an episode, I make a transcript for each and every episode of the podcast. So if you prefer to read the details, you can do so there. Anything else, Megan?
Yeah, just one other thing. I wanted to give a shout out to my colleagues and mentors at UC Davis. The study could not have been done without them. And while I'm the one that here today talking with Chris about the study, they were a huge, huge part of it. I was truly standing on the shoulders of giants. So thank you to all of you guys out there.
Not the royal we, but rather the scientists that you worked with on the study.
Correct.
Excellent. Okay, well, now over to the podcast. Hello, and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly, and today I'm joined by my scientific director, Megan Roberts. How are you doing this morning, Megan?
I'm well. How are you, Chris?
I'm great. Thank you very much for asking. Megan is a research scientist who recently joined me as scientific director at Nourish Balance Thrive, where she keeps the program state of the art. She received her undergraduate degree in exercise biology and master's in nutritional biology at UC Davis, where her research focused on the effects of low carbohydrate and ketogenic diets on longevity and health span in mice. That is the topic of today's discussion, so stay tuned for more. In her free time, Megan enjoys reading long walks in the sunshine. Big fan of that, Megan. Weightlifting, martial arts, and hiking in the Colorado mountains. Megan, you're so cool. I'm so happy to have you. You know, I attended this Mastermind Talks event earlier this year, and one of the things that Jason Gaynard says on his website for Mastermind Talks is that if you are the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I feel that now that you've joined me as a full-time employee, I'm finally in that room where I'm the dumbest person in the room, and I'm very, very excited about it. So thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, well, it's my absolute pleasure.
I'm sorry, we can't all be the dumbest person in the room. Somebody has to be smarter than me, and I'm okay with that. I apologize to you, though.
Oh, no, I'm constantly learning from you and Dr. Tommy Wood and the rest of the team as well. So it goes both ways for sure.
Perhaps the important thing then is just our perception that we are the dumbest person in the room. Perhaps it's the only thing that matters.
I like that.
Well, let's talk about your keto study. I'm very, very excited about your keto study. Take me back to the beginning. Tell me about how you decided it was a good idea for an experiment.
All right. So basically, kind of the background of the study is that, and I'm sure many people are aware, but calorie restriction has been shown to dramatically extend longevity in many animal models. Of course, there are some potential confounders for that, which you've discussed on the podcast before. So for example, there might be a time-restricted eating or circadian rhythm effect. So with an animal that's calorie-restricted, typically you feed them and they clean up their meal almost instantaneously. They don't have the opportunity to graze throughout the day. And so that could be a potential confounder in the calorie restriction literature. And also, of course, food quality. Are they living longer because they're just eating less of a crappy diet? That's always a question as well. So the impetus for the study that I did at UC Davis was kind of we wanted to mimic calorie restriction by manipulating dietary macronutrients, namely carbohydrates in our case. And so a kind of a hallmark of energy restriction across the board is this metabolic shift from carbohydrate to fat oxidation. And so since the mechanisms of calorie restriction are still largely subject of debate, what we wanted to do was answer this question of whether or not the shift from carbohydrate to fatty acid oxidation contributes to the longevity promoting properties of calorie restriction, and then also how do ketones play into that as well.
Very interesting. Before we get into the study design, I want you to talk a little bit more about how you realized that this experiment was going to be a fun and interesting and informative thing to do. So you're at university. How do you even know about the ketogenic diet and calorie restriction? You know, we hear so much about how, you know, that these things are not really taught to people who are on the road to medical school. So tell me about how this all went down at university.
Right. So I was very lucky to be a part of a cohort in my nutritional biology program who had some very open-minded instructors and professors, and my peers were also very open-minded. And so that really helped. I could bounce a lot of these, you know, questions off of them. And then also I was very lucky to kind of end up in a lab that the focus was of calorie restriction and the mechanisms.
Okay.
And so my mentor was very excited about that. And then this kind of idea of low-carb and ketogenic diets mimicking calorie restriction kind of been a question, an unanswered question for a long time in our lab, at least.
Okay.
So I was very fortunate to kind of come into this project at the right time as a master's student. So,
correct me if I'm wrong here. So does this all go down? You've got this mentor, some senior academic at the university, and they've read all these studies and they've read all these studies over there, and they had some questions from the first set of studies and some questions from the second set. And they said, you know what? If this is true and this is true, then maybe this is true. And Megan, I want you to do this experiment, or I want you to be involved in this experiment that we're going to do to answer some of my unanswered questions. Is that how it works, or am I completely off track there?
Basically, for me at least, that's how it kind of went down.
Okay.
And I'm, like I said, I'm very, very blessed to have had this amazing opportunity to kind of fall into my hands. And I came in at exactly the right time when the study was started. So, you know, it kind of all worked out. And Dr. Steve Finney, he was a previous professor at UC Davis. And so I'm not quite sure if he paved the way, but my mentor, John Ramsey, I'm sure, you know, learned some stuff from him. And so there's that aspect as well.
Okay. This is all very interesting for me. I hope it's interesting for my listeners as well. You know, I read some of these academic studies and I watch lots of presentations and go to conferences and all this kind of stuff. But I always wonder, what's it really like, you know, at university when these studies are started? It's difficult to know from the outside when all you're doing is reading the paper. Very, very exciting. Well, let's move on then and talk about the study design.
Okay. So first of all, we did the study in mice. So that's very important. We used three different diets. So there was a control diet, which is just a typical kind of chow rodent diet, which is about 65% carbohydrate. And then we had a low carbohydrate diet, which was 70% fat, 10% carb, 20% protein. And then our ketogenic diet was 90% fat and 10% protein and zero carb. So these mice, we started them on the diets at 12 months of age, which is about middle age for a mouse. And one important thing is that all of the mice were eating 11.2 kcals per day. So they were being fed isocalorically, so that we could study the effects of these diets independent of either overweight or obesity. Because typically when you feed a rodent ad libitum, especially a high-fat ad libitum diet, then they're going to gain weight. And that's one of the issues kind of with a traditional high-fat rodent diets, is that they're both high-fat and high-carb. Neither of our low-carb diets were high in carbohydrate, relatively speaking. But traditionally, these high-fat diets that you see in the literature as being so bad and so obesity-promoting, they're doing that metabolically because they are both high-fat and high-carbohydrate.
So this is helpful. This is useful information, you know, for our listeners. You've got to watch out for this caveat that when they say a high-fat diet fed to rodents, you really have to understand what the diet was. It doesn't give you enough information to know.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And one of the important parts, like I mentioned, of our study is that these mice were all being fed the same amount of calories every day. And so it's important to kind of note that these optimal dietary macronutrients might differ between a mouse that is fed ad libitum and one that is not. So that's, you know, kind of a little caveat there. But if you think about it, you know, humans aren't really, technically, we're not really fed ad libitum either. We can, obviously, we can eat you know, to satiety, but most of us don't just sit around and eat all day because we're bored, which is what a mouse usually does in a cage if they're, you know, given the opportunity.
I used to do that. When I worked a day job as a programmer at a hedge fund, I used to do that all the time.
Okay, well, some of us do then.
But that's a different problem.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So kind of moving on, we had two different arms of our study. There was a longevity arm where we basically, these mice kind of got the good end of the study where they got to just kind of live out a natural lifespan and die when they died. And then we measured longevity curves from that. And then we also had a health span part of the study where we tested different markers of physiological function known to decline with age. And so the health span part is really important, I think, going forward in all of these aging and longevity studies, even in animals, because for translation to humans, basically the best interventions that we have will ultimately improve both longevity and also prevent the decline in physiological function that we see with age. And so we don't just want to live longer, we want to get more out of the years that we do live. And so I think that looking at this health span part is important as well as the lifespan.
Okay, let me summarize those two words. That's really, really important, isn't it? That health span is this idea of feeling good and being healthy for a long time, whereas lifespan might just mean extending life, which if your quality of life is quite low, may not be a desirable thing.
Exactly, yes. And so for that kind of health span cohort, we, like I said, these tests of physiological functions that we did them at two different time points. So we had one group of mice that we did the tests on after they were on the diet for 1 month, and then one, which is like middle age, and then another group of mice after 13 months of being on the diet. So that's when they were reaching, you know, definitely old age there. And so these tests that we did included grip strength, wire test, a rearing test, which measured motor function and endurance. Also a memory test called the novel object test. We did body composition, glucose and insulin tolerance tests. And then we also measured energy expenditure in food digestibility. And then also at the end, when the mice were sacrificed, we did some tissue analysis and looked at specific proteins in liver and muscle that are associated with longevity and lifespan.
Okay. So I'm going to have you unpack some of these things for our listeners, because I think this is fantastic. So talk about how you measure grip strength in a rodent.
So we have this little force apparatus that the mice basically, it's quite comical actually when you're doing some of these tests, because trying to get a mice to hold onto a little metal bar and pull as hard as they can is not the easiest thing in the world. And so what we had to do was there was this little metal bar that they held on to, and we held them by the tails, and then they would grab the bar with their forepaws. And what we had to do was hold their cup of food right in front of them so that they would want to get to the food, and we would tug on them, and then they would tug on the bar to get to the food. So that's how we measured grip strength.
That's awesome. And then talk about the novel object test. How did that work?
So the novel object test, basically what you do is you have a box that's kind of a novel environment for a mouse. And you put the mouse inside. The first day you just do kind of an adaptation to the environment, kind of so they get used to it. Mm. And then the second day, what you do is you start with two of the same objects. So we use boxes and bottles. So we had, for one mouse, we would have two boxes in there, and we would video record the mouse for 10 minutes. And the mouse would just explore around the boxes. And then 6 hours later, we would replace one of the objects. We would replace a box with a bottle. So the bottle was the novel object. And then we would do another 10-minute recording of the mouse. And the mouse would be exploring. And we would then go back and watch the video recordings, which is a long process. I would not. But we would watch the mouse and compare the time that the mouse spends from the novel to the old object. And the idea is if they spend more time exploring the novel object, then that's a better indication of their short-term memory versus if they're just kind of looking at both objects the same amount of time.
Okay, interesting. And then body composition, how do you measure that?
So we use fMRI machine. So you just kind of put a little mouse in a tube, and then it takes about 90 seconds for each mouse, and it pops out some numbers as far as, you know, fat mass and lean mass and water mass and that kind of stuff.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, let's talk about the results then.
All right. So as far as lifespan is concerned, the ketogenic diet ultimately compared to the control diet increased median lifespan by almost 14%, so 13.6%. And it is important to note here that we're looking at median and not maximum. Maximum was not changed with any of the diets. And there is some disagreement among aging experts and gerontologists about which is more important to look at. But ultimately, I think they're both important. Maximum can be kind of clouded by a couple stubborn mice that refuse to die. And calorie restriction extends both maximum and median lifespan. Mm.
So just as a reminder, when we say median, we're talking about the average.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, mean and average are the same. Median is if you line up all the ages in numerical
average.
Value. Yeah. Right. And then you take the middle number. That's the median.
Right, right, right.
And so median is an important indicator that an intervention is delaying the onset of mortality, even if maximum lifespan has not changed. And so interestingly, exercise in rodents has been shown to increase median, but not maximum lifespan. So basically what it's doing is slowing age-specific mortality. And ultimately, even if we can't increase maximum lifespan, what we want to do is square this lifespan curve. So we want to live a long, healthy life, which ultimately will be followed by a sudden fatal death, which sounds a little bit brutal, but if you think about it, it's what you want. You want to live long and healthy and then kind of die suddenly.
Right. So that's a huge increase, 13.6 compared to control. Were you expecting a change as big as that?
No, we weren't. None of us in our lab were. And the low-carb diet was somewhere in the middle. I believe it was about 7% increase compared to control. But this increase by almost 14% was a surprise to all of us.
Right. And so keto best, low-carb goods, high-carb was the worst of all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on and talk about the preserved memory with age.
So this we measured, like I said, with this novel object recognition test. And so the ketogenic mice ultimately spent more time exploring the novel object versus the old object that second time around in the test. So that is indicating that their memory is being preserved with age. And interestingly, Walter Longo's fasting mimicking diet, which I think you're aware of. Yeah?
Yes, yes, of course. And I will link to some resources for the fasting mimicking diet. Very interesting stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So that is actually, in one of their studies, they showed that the fasting mimicking diet in rodents also improved memory in mice with this novel object test as well. So this kind of preserved memory with age indicates that there may potentially be some kind of neuroprotective properties of ketone bodies, specifically beta-hydroxybutyrate. And so this is in line with some of the literature about ketogenic diets being helpful for neurodegenerative and psychiatric conditions. Mm. And there's also a link in the literature between beta-hydroxybutyrate and brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which has been kind of coined as one of the beneficial side effects of exercise, specifically endurance exercise.
And I remember that one paper that showed that the increases in brain-derived neurotrophic factor after exercise was caused by the increase in beta-hydroxybutyrate. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yes. So they're thinking that the beta-hydroxybutyrate is responsible for that increase in BDNF following endurance exercise.
Incredibly
so impressive. That's interesting that there's maybe this potential effect with a nutritional ketosis as well.
Mm-hmm. I will, of course, link to that study in the show notes for this episode. You can find those over at nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. Drill down to a particular show and then an episode. You'll find the show notes. I make a very comprehensive time map where I link to all of the things that we've been talking about in this episode. Megan, talk about the preserved motor function and coordination with age.
Okay, so this was really exciting as well. The two areas of health span that we saw the most dramatic effects with the ketogenic diet were, of course, the memory that we already talked about, and then this preservation of motor function and coordination in the ketogenic group compared to the other two diets. And so the two tests we used to test for motor function and coordination were the wire test and then the grip strength test. And we found both of those more favorable in the old ketogenic mice versus the other two diets. And also when we dissected the muscles at the time of sacrifice, we found that the muscle mass in the hind limbs were greater in the old ketogenic mice. And specifically, the gastrocnemius, which is predominantly type 2 or fast twitch fibers, that muscle mass was higher in the ketogenic mice. And the importance of this is that with age, type 2 fibers are typically the first to go. And so if we're seeing a preservation of these type 2 fibers, or at least the muscle in which type 2 fibers are more highly concentrated, then that's really important as far as preserving those type 2 fibers with age.
Okay, and we've talked about this on the podcast before. Does this mean that these rodents are less likely to slip up in the shower, break a hip, end up in the emergency room, potentially picking up a pneumonia, and then dying early in hospital?
Yes. If we're translating to humans, then that would be kind of the extrapolation that you would make, for sure.
Okay.
Yep. And then, so also another kind of interesting tidbit of information from the previous literature is that, and I believe, I almost want to say that Ken Ford has brought this up before. I think it was brought up on the Keto Summit, but acetoacetate has been shown to preserve muscular dystrophy or improve muscular dystrophy outcomes and accelerate muscle regeneration in mice. And so acetoacetate, along with beta-hydroxybutyrate, so acetoacetate is another ketone body, may be an important player in attenuating this age-related loss of muscle function that we see. So we didn't kind of decipher between the two ketone bodies, but mechanistically, acetoacetate and beta-hydroxybutyrate might be kind of synergistically playing a role in that.
Okay, talk about ketones and exercise performance.
So sure, a lot of the listeners are aware there's lots of interest about either ketogenic diets or exogenous ketones in this realm of increasing exercise performance. And so the results of our study that we saw with this preserved motor function and coordination, at least with age, indicate that there is potentially some correlation to ketone bodies and, you know, potential exercise performance. The exact mechanism has yet to be elucidated, but certainly we have some hypotheses, which include changes in amino acid metabolism in the muscle, regulating the actual muscle cell function, increasing mitochondrial mass and function, and also enhancing skeletal muscle metabolic efficiency. So these are all hypotheses of how ketones could be affecting muscle performance.
Okay. And is it a particular type of exercise performance? So we need to be more specific here. Are the mice going to do better at Ironman, but perhaps worse at CrossFit?
I would assume so, yeah, just because of the fuel preferences.
Okay.
With fat versus carbs, I would assume that if you were to have a mouse run an Ironman or, you know, do a Fran workout, they would fare a lot better on the Ironman.
Okay. Talk about the keto diet impaired glucose tolerance but not insulin sensitivity. That's interesting.
Yeah, so this is really, really interesting. A lot of times we hear anecdotally about this kind of impaired glucose tolerance when you're eating a low carb or ketogenic diet. And it's important to note that this is definitely a thing for some people, but it's physiological and not pathological. So not consuming glucose, if you think about it for a long period of time, kind of causes your cells not to need that glycolytic metabolic machinery, and the pathways for metabolizing glucose don't need to be working at 100% capacity because there's no glucose around. There's some blood glucose, but exogenous glucose from your diet isn't really coming in. And so this is kind of a little bit similar to something like gestational diabetes, where when the mother is eating a low carbohydrate diet and then they go in and do a glucose tolerance test, they could potentially come out as looking slightly diabetic, where if they had potentially, you know, taken 2 weeks to add a little bit more carbohydrate into their diet, then those glucose metabolizing pathways would have upregulated and they would have looked exactly, you know, perfectly glucose tolerant.
Right.
So with
right.
these mice, since they had spent a long time not eating any glucose, they did look slightly glucose intolerant, but importantly, their insulin sensitivity was not impaired.
Okay. So I'm trying to be funny here, switching backwards and forwards between humans and rodents, but these comparisons are real, right? We see that working with clients. It is a real phenomenon. This really is happening in humans.
Yeah, absolutely. And for what does this mean for us as far as, you know, if somebody is embarking on a long-term ketogenic diet and then, you know, for maybe some metabolic reasons, and then they want to start eating more of a mixed macronutrient diet, then potentially you want to go slow when you're reintroducing the carbohydrates.
Right.
You know, just a practical application there.
And it's funny that you pick on this example of gestational diabetes, because Julie is now 6 months pregnant and the midwife sent her this oral glucose tolerance test, and we agreed to pop it in the bin because it was silly. She's not eating a very low carbohydrate diet, but almost certainly much lower than many of the other women that the midwives work with. And it just wasn't a realistic test. You know, they were asking her to eat a ton of refined carbohydrate and then test to see if something silly had happened after doing something you knew was going to be silly.
Yep. I'm right there with you.
Sorry. It's unclear who I'm talking to at the moment. So talk about low carb versus keto.
Okay. So a couple of things I want to say here. First of all, if you look at the lifespan curves in the study, and I can give you, you know, a link to the study or a link to the PDF, or so you can post the study in the show notes and people can read it if they would like. But basically, the low carbohydrate diet didn't significantly differ in longevity compared to the ketogenic diet, but it didn't result in preservation of the physiological function with age. So this suggests that while the metabolic changes that accompany carbohydrate restriction may help increase lifespan, there's something going on with the ketone bodies that may be necessary to elicit this extension of health span. So that's one kind of point I wanted to make. And then the other point that some people, you know, astute readers might pick up while they're reading the paper is this fact that despite the same caloric load of all three diets, the low carbohydrate diet actually caused some weight gain despite this isocaloric load. And this still remains a mystery to date. We did food digestibility tests, we did energy expenditure tests. And so it's kind of a mystery as to why the low carb diet mice were specifically heavier, and most of that mass came from more fat mass. So even though it's still kind of uncertain as to why that happened, there are some hypotheses out there. It could be, you know, it was just the right mix of carbohydrate and fat for a mouse to kind of elicit some fat gain. It could be the gut microbiome, and it could also have been the consistency of the diet. So this is potentially the most reasonable hypothesis. But the—
Sorry, can I just clarify, which is the most reasonable hypothesis?
The consistency of the diet differed. Right. So the control diet, they were all made of the same ingredients, but the control diet, since it was higher in carbohydrate, was more powdery. And so the mice might have made a little bit of a mess while eating it. And then the ketogenic diet was very sticky because it was very high in fat.
Ah.
And so they kind of had to work really hard at cleaning up their food, whereas the low carbohydrate diet was more like Play-Doh. And so basically, these low carb mice could take their diet in a little ball and kind of go into a corner of the cage and just kind of munch on it. And they didn't have to expend more calories eating it than the other two diets. Just a hypothesis, but you know, it's kind of interesting to think about. And then the question from this arises, if the low carbohydrate diet were truly weight matched with the other two diet groups, would they have performed better in the test of physiological function?
Okay. Can you just explain that term, weight matched?
Yeah. So if they were the same weight as—
So we're talking about body mass?
Yes. Body mass. Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. That's interesting. Talk about ketones as signaling molecules.
All right. So there is quite a bit of literature now, at least mechanistic literature, explaining the role of ketone bodies signaling molecules. And there's a couple really good review articles that I can have you post in the show notes. But basically, these ketone bodies can upregulate longevity promoting pathways. And one of the— these, just kind of taking a step back here, these pathways that I'm going to talk about next are pathways that we found to be upregulated in the study that I did. I'm sure there are many other pathways that ketones are working on, but as far as what we found is this idea that ketones function as HDAC inhibitors. And basically what that means is to elicit gene expression, DNA is basically consistently being coiled and uncoiled around histones by adding and removing these little acetyl groups. And acetyl group is a CH3COOH. And histone deacetylases basically remove the acetyl groups from proteins. And deacetylating proteins, or removing the acetyl group, causes the condensation of the chromatin and then the silencing of the genes. And so this can either be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on which proteins are getting deacetylated. And if you think about it, HDAC inhibition is blocking the deacetylation and resulting in hyperacetylation, or at least more acetylation, of these histone proteins. And this is impacting gene expression. And so what that means, kind of big picture, is that these proteins are, depending on the amount of either acetylation or deacetylation, this is just a little, you know, a tag kind of, you can think of it as tagging the protein with this in the acetyl group or removing the tag on a protein. And that little tag causes the gene to either be expressed or not expressed.
Okay. This is super interesting and very difficult to understand in an audio format. And
yeah.
Do you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a look online and I'm going to see if I can find my best Khan Academy video. Now, I've done this before, and this is something I do quite often when somebody talks about something I don't fully understand on the podcast, is I'll go back to the Khan Academy and I'll look at maybe some of the MCAT videos are very, very good. And I've done that before on this topic. And at the end of watching those videos, I felt like I still didn't get it quite 100%. And maybe now that you've just challenged me with this new problem, I'll get it just a little bit more. And I'll talk to you, Megan, about which are the best videos that we can link to in the show notes so that people can watch those when they've got a chance to try and understand this idea of HDAC inhibitors, because it keeps cropping up over and over again, doesn't it? On the podcast, in the literature, whenever someone talks about ketogenic diets. So I think it's an important topic for us to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sorry if that wasn't the most articulate explanation.
You did a really good job. And it's a complicated topic that, like I say, is not necessarily best taught using this medium.
Exactly. Yeah, I completely agree. And potentially the review paper that I'll have you post in the show notes, I don't recall if it has a good diagram, but it might have an excellent diagram kind of showing, visualizing the process of HDAC inhibition. So that can also be helpful for people to take a look at as well. But if we then narrow in on why HDAC inhibition is important in the context of this study, is that HDAC inhibition has been shown to upregulate these FOXO proteins, which are pro-longevity. And FOXO proteins basically are transcription factors that act as regulators of longevity and also downstream insulin signaling and insulin-like growth factor signaling. And HDAC inhibition has also been shown to extend lifespan in yeast and flies. That's kind of how it links in with this study. And beta-hydroxybutyrate in particular has been shown to be an HDAC inhibitor. And then in the study that we did, we showed, when looking at the liver and muscle tissues, we showed a dramatically increased acetylation of lysine protein or residues on proteins. And this basically suggests that the beta-hydroxybutyrate is indeed acting as an HDAC inhibitor. So that's HDAC inhibition. A little bit of a mouthful, but there it is. We also found in the ketogenic diet that there was an increase in manganese superoxide dismutase expression, and this is basically a mitochondrial antioxidant. So more antioxidants in the mitochondria may be promoting this longevity effect as well.
Okay.
And finally, we come to this idea that ketogenic diets potentially are regulating mTOR signaling. So mTOR has been implied or implicated in many kind of long lifespan models and models of disease, specifically cancer. I know Dr. Ron Rosedale has talked about this extensively, and he is kind of the mTOR expert. So maybe you can link to one of his presentations or something in the show notes.
Yeah, we heard him speak at Low Carb Breckenridge earlier this year, and he's done many other good talks too.
Yeah. And so, but kind of before we get into how mTOR might be working with the ketogenic diet, I do want to say that there is a lack of understanding about this trade-off between lower mTOR for longevity purposes and then higher mTOR and maybe promoting it in skeletal muscle to protect against sarcopenia. So there is this tissue-dependent manner by which we want to, you know, kind of look at as far as okay, mTOR in our mice, mTOR was signaling was slightly elevated in the muscle and depressed in the liver. And you would think that that would be good for longevity. You know, it's keeping muscle mass up, but it's lower in the liver. So mTOR isn't always bad, but it's not always chronic mTOR stimulation around the body isn't always good.
So, you know, it's maybe important to point out here that while Nourish Balance Thrive perhaps disagrees with some of Dr. Rosedale's conclusions, he was still the first person to even name mTOR. I'd literally never heard of that pathway before he'd mentioned it. So yeah, interesting to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. So in our mice, we basically found that this protein called RED1 or DDIT4 was upregulated in the ketogenic mice. And this protein is a negative regulator of mTOR. And this RED1 protein is activated by a couple different things, but in our case, it's probably energy stress, metabolic stress, the good type of stress, like we like to call hormetic stressor.
Okay.
In the ketogenic diet, that would be upregulating this protein. And then if you upregulate the RED1, basically it's inhibiting the mTOR. And let's see. Also, the P53 protein is a tumor suppressor protein, and we found it to be hyperacetylated in the ketogenic group. And interestingly, hyperacetylation of P53 also inhibits mTOR by increasing RED1 expression. And this same pathway also seems to mediate the effects of metformin, which is the anti-diabetic drug that has been proposed as another type of calorie restriction mimetic. So something's going on with mTOR here. Again, there are many other questions to be answered. A lot of times these studies kind of promote more questions than they do answers. But again, it opens lots of doors for more people to kind of step in and figure out what's going on. And then, so I briefly mentioned this P53 protein that was hyperacetylated. And I do just want to say that the ketogenic mice upon sacrifice had less cancer, specifically liver tumors. And so there's this kind of interest in the cancer research field right now of ketogenic diets being an adjunct therapy to traditional chemotherapy. And so this study actually supports the fact that ketogenic diets, I don't want to say that they are preventative cancer treatment, but, you know, the ketogenic diet, we did see less cancer in those mice. So there's something going on there potentially with the Warburg effect and lower glucose availability, you know, another kind of avenue to be explored by researchers. But that was interesting as well.
Okay. These results, tell me, would they likely be repeatable? So if another lab were to do similar experiments, would they find the same results?
So replicability is a huge issue in science, and people always are kind of asking the question of, you know, if you see such dramatic results in one study like we did ours, you know, this 13.6% increase in median lifespan, and then the preservation of physiological function with age in these mice being fed the ketogenic diet, is that replicable if another lab, you know, independently did the same study? And so kind of serendipitously, it's a long story, but I'll make it short. I ran in at a conference, John Newmick and Eric Verdin, who are amazing researchers at UCSF, and they were doing a similar study to my own. And the limitations of the study that I did were largely addressed in theirs and vice versa. So,
oh, that's fantastic.
So for instance, they matched all of their groups for protein. They used a cyclical ketogenic diet to stabilize the weight gain in the ketogenic diet group. And then they also used different fat sources than we did for their high fat diets and ketogenic diets. So that study you can also link to in the show notes, but it was also published alongside ours in Cell Metabolism.
Okay. And were the findings broadly the same or different in any important ways?
They were largely the same. Some were slightly different. So for instance, they didn't see on the wire test the same preservation of muscle function. And I'm guessing that was because their ketogenic diet group were cyclical. So they were cycling weight, basically. They were, you know, decreasing weight quite a bit throughout the weeks. And so that could have had a potential detrimental effect on their muscle mass. But otherwise, their effects were largely the same, and they looked at a lot of similar and also different cell signaling. And so if people are interested to dive in, then I would highly recommend reading that one as well.
Interesting. Let's talk about some of the caveats.
Okay, so these studies are super exciting. The media definitely picked up on them and kind of ran with the conclusions that the researchers may or may not agree with.
Right. Let me step in here and I'll say something. So this paper, the science that Megan is talking about was published in the journal Cell Metabolism, which on its own is seriously impressive. And then it was also picked up by Science Daily and many other popular science sources. So obviously important work, and congratulations on that, Megan. But okay, let's go back to the caveats.
Okay, so caveats, and there are many caveats, but I'll kind of just highlight a couple that I think are most important here. Obviously, when translating animal research to human research, we do have to recognize that we're not mice. We don't live like them, most of us anyway. They live very sheltered lives in cages. They're protected from their environment. They have less day-to-day variability than we do. And so, you know, the optimal diet for a mouse in that kind of environment may be different from the optimal diet of a human who's having, you know, environmental stressors bombard them every day, who's doing, you know, extensive exercise training, who's, you know, just has day-to-day stressors that might impact them. And then also, there's the whole issue of diet quality that comes up. So the mice in these studies were eating processed food diet composed mainly of soybean oil, lard, maltodextrin, and casein. And that's not something that anybody that I know eats. So, you know, diet quality is definitely an issue there.
Just to kind of just interrupt you there.
Yeah.
Why was the diet constructed in this way? You know, I've made this criticism before of these science rodent diets. Like, we already know that soybean oil is no good. Why does it continue to be used in experiments?
Excellent question. And I wish I had the answer. If I could do like the next study, I would love, I mean, there's lots of studies that I would want to do, but I would want to do a study that looked at what a wild mouse diet would look like and compare that to, you know, something else. So in the wild, mice eat lots of seeds and fruits and grains and plant matter and even other animals. So they're very omnivorous versus this kind of artificially constructed lab diet of oil and maltodextrin and casein. So I don't have a good answer for you, but it is something that people need to pay attention to.
Right.
For sure.
Could I make a suggestion? Is it because your experiment is then more easily compared to somebody else's work because you've used a diet that's constructed in a similar way? And so perhaps it's easier to build on someone else's work. Could that be a potential reason?
Yeah, I think so for sure. We handmade all of our diets, but you know, the recipe is largely available to anybody who wants to replicate it.
Right.
So that's probably definitely a factor there for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And then kind of the last caveat that I want to mention is that both of these studies were done with male mice. And so mice and humans both age in a sex-dependent manner. That's well known in the literature. And so the question arises of what would these results look like with female mice as well? Anecdotally, we see that women seem to respond different to a ketogenic diet than men do. And that's probably due to hormonal differences and other factors as well. So I think that more studies need to be done on female animals to contrast the results to males.
And since we're here, can you explain why male rodents are normally used for this type of experiment?
So it's a lot easier to control for the hormonal fluctuations throughout the month in males. With the female cycle, we would have had to have done all of our tests of physiological function at a certain time of each month to make sure that everything was controlled for hormonally. So that's typically why just males are used in rodent studies. But fortunately, the NIA and the NIH have, I believe they've made it a requirement from here on out that many studies will have to include both sexes in their research, which is great. It will take, you know, a little bit more resources and time on the part of the researchers, but I think that it'll give us a lot missing information.
Right. This is important for people like me and our listeners to understand that I think there's a lot of stuff that goes unsaid by scientists because they just know and it's common knowledge, whereas amongst the lay public, not so much. And of course, if you don't understand these differences, then you can run into trouble when making your conclusions. So yeah, thank you for explaining that.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, so what are the takeaways? What does this mean for the future of aging research?
Okay, so I mean, I'm sure many people will kind of read the studies and take their own little nuggets of information away.
I'm throwing away my sweet potatoes as you talk.
Excellent. No, not really. I'm a fan of the sweet potatoes. So as far as the future of aging research is concerned in animals, both of these studies are really important because they showed that an energy-controlled high-fat diet is not detrimental to health. And kind of the ancestral health paleosphere, we know this. We see metabolic disease and other kind of health conditions being reversed when we're dropping the processed carbohydrates and increasing the dietary fat in the diet, as long as it's the healthy kind of fat. So we know that high-fat diets aren't detrimental to health, but a lot of the kind of conventional nutrition and medical world still have yet to believe it.
Right. There is some dogma that needs to be displaced.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, more studies in the future, especially with high-fat diets in human subjects, will make this stronger point for sure. And, you know, like I kind of alluded to before, while this study certainly answered some questions, some important questions, it probably opened 10 times as many doors as far as new questions that need to be asked and researched. And so I think that more studies in the future should look at the exact mechanisms by which a ketogenic diet is working to enhance lifespan and health span.
Oh, you scientists, you always say that. It's almost as if you want some more experiments to do.
I know. And then many people will kind of be wondering, okay, we use nutritional ketosis for our experiment, but what if you induced ketosis with exogenous ketones? There's lots of interest in exogenous ketones, esters and salts recently. And so that's another kind of question that remains to be answered as far as how that would, you know, exogenous ketones on top of maybe a control diet, a high carb diet, how that would affect aging.
And what are your thoughts? I know that the science hasn't been done yet, but can I tempt you to express an opinion on whether it may be possible to reap the benefits that you've been talking about by using an exogenous source of ketones, whatever that might be, over some sort of dietary manipulation?
Yeah. So I kind of find it hard to believe that it would be as good as nutritional ketosis. I think that in a healthy animal or a healthy person, especially if they were already, like if it was a mouse who is being fed ad libitum, I think that exogenous ketones on top of a hypercaloric diet is probably a recipe for disaster. If the animals were already, you know, slightly caloric restricted, maybe just a few percent under maintenance, then adding exogenous ketones on top of that might be, you know, you might see favorable things with that in that case.
Okay. Well, let's move on to the $64,000 question, which is, what does this mean for human longevity and health span?
Okay, so I will admit that it doesn't mean too much for humans. However, at a fundamental level, I will say that humans and mice do age similarly. So there's a decrease in overall organ function and physiological function with age in both mice and humans. And then the results of the study also tell us that dietary manipulation, even without weight loss, manipulating the macronutrients can impact longevity and health. Although, like I said, there are many other questions to be answered. And these studies only tell us about macronutrients and nothing about dietary quality. So addressing both the macros and the quality, so the idea of a well-formulated ketogenic diet in either a mouse or a human, could potentially yield even more profound results as far as longevity and health span.
You touched on something interesting there, which is maybe another thing that goes unsaid amongst scientists, and that's about weight loss. And so am I right in thinking that sometimes people would assume, or scientists would assume, that the benefits you saw were something to do with weight loss and nothing to do with the composition of the diet?
Exactly, yes. And that is why, you know, we looked at these diets in an isocaloric fashion, so that we can look at the effect of macronutrient manipulation without any kind of weight gain or weight loss. So that was an important part of the study for sure. Yeah. And just kind of to, I guess I should ask, do you have any more questions about that? Or should I lead on to the next topic here?
No, move on.
So one thing I do want to make clear is that while we like to talk about diet in this paleo ancestral health sphere, we know that diet is critical to good health. However, I see too many people wanting to micromanage all the details. So, you know, asking exactly how many carbohydrate grams they should be eating a day, or exactly what number of blood ketones is optimal. And I personally think, you know, working with people at Nourish, Balance, Thrive, and my own personal experience, just eating real whole unprocessed foods will take most people most of the way. And on top of that, we know that other things are important as well. So not only diet, but we have sleep and social connection and stress management and circadian rhythm and all of these other important lifestyle factors that play into both our longevity and health span as well.
Yeah, and I should clarify here that Megan has been not just doing science, but working with many of our clients at Nourish, Balance, Thrive. And so that's how she can speak from experience, which I think is really important and in some ways makes you somewhat unique, right? How many of your peers in the lab were also working with real human beings in real life? But not many, I'm sure.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, many, many people in my lab and many people kind of who I was talking to about this study as it was progressing switched their diet from, you know, regular standard diet to keto. And keto can be great for some people, especially short term. You know, people who have metabolic syndrome or diabetes, neurologic conditions, some cancer potentially could be great for endurance athletes. At a certain time in their training can be a good short-term therapy for gut dysfunction, but it's not a panacea. So if everybody who listens to this just takes out all the sweet potatoes from their diet, you know, it's not going to be a panacea, but it certainly is a therapeutic tool for sure.
I feel like I've heard Rob Wolf utter many very important words, but who are you and what are your goals are perhaps some of the most important, right? It's not just for everyone, it's who are you and what are your goals?
Exactly. Yeah, I cannot agree more with that.
And we talked about this the last time you were on the podcast, that you tried some of the keto diet and perhaps the diet was not very well aligned with some of your training goals and it didn't work out very well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not to say that, you know, years down the road, a ketogenic diet might work for me.
Right.
It's going to be individual depending on what's going on in your life and what your goals are for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And you touch on another very important point, which I want to reiterate, which is in the beginning, I thought it was just about diet, right? In 2013, I thought I'd figured it all out. All I needed to do was change my diet and it was all unicorns and rainbows. Everything would be fine. And then over the years, with the help of our good friend and chief medical officer, Dr. Tommy Wood and his research, I've discovered all these other variables. And, you know, some people call them pillars. I'm not quite sure that's the most appropriate term anymore because there's so many of them to think of. But yeah, it's not just all about diet. There's so many other moving parts. And of course, we can only talk about one thing at a time on the podcast. But, you know, you have to listen to all of the shows in order to know all of the things. And actually, maybe the best thing for people to do now is come to nourishbalancethrive.com/highlights, where Tommy is giving away this incredible playbook that he's constructed over the years working with us at MBT and, of course, throughout his career in traditional academia and medical doctoring. And he's giving it away in a weekly installment. So you can read something, think about it, am I doing that or not? Add it into your routine. And then the next week you get something else to think about and maybe add in. And so it's been dripped to you in weekly installments. And so if you're thinking, okay, Chris, you've said that there's all these other components, but how do I know about them? What are they? What do I do about it? Then that's what you should do is come to nourishbalancethrive.com/highlights and sign up for that weekly installment. Well, Megan, this has been absolutely phenomenal. Congratulations on your work. I hope that we can continue to do science and publish some of the data that we've collected from the athletes that we work with how do you feel about that? I mean, I want to ask you, what is your purpose now? Is this something you want to continue doing, or are you more about working with people and being a practitioner of some sorts?
You know, I have to say that I'm really passionate about both. Before my master's degree, I was all gung-ho about more of the clinical side and working with people. And then when I got my feet wet in research, it kind of sparked a passion there. And so I think that, you know, if I can go forward and kind of have one foot in a little bit of research and one foot in a little bit of the clinical side working with people, I would be thrilled.
Interesting. You know, I've just finished reading an excellent book, which is called Finding Your Why by Simon Sinek, just came out recently. And I think it'd be really interesting to get all of us at MBT together and go through some of the methods that Simon describes in that book. And the goal is to find your purpose, to understand your why. And maybe one day we'll find this out, because Simon thinks that there is only one why, right? There's only one purpose. You can't have more than one. So it would be really interesting to try and discover that with you. But for now, thank you so much for all this incredible information. Congratulations on the paper being published in the journal Cell Metabolism. It's incredibly impressive. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, we are absolutely delighted to have you. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And it was my pleasure, for sure.
Thank you.